Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. and Russia have brokered a localized 48-hour ceasefire over the Syrian city Aleppo, where fierce fighting between government and rebel forces has left nearly 300 civilians dead in the past 2 weeks. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Wednesday said the truce, in effect for several hours, appeared to have had an effect on the fighting.
Since then, we've seen an overall decrease in the violence in those areas, even though there are some reports of continued fighting in some locations, which does not surprise us because it only went into effect 1 minute after midnight, and we have to communicate, and we are working at that process of communication.
Washington and Moscow are co-chairs of a ceasefire task force, been working to salvage a nationwide cessation of hostilities that took effect in late February but has been undermined by violence. Meanwhile, the UN humanitarian chief, Stephen O'Brien, told an emergency session of the UN Security Council Wednesday the civilian suffering must stop.
Life for people in Aleppo is horrendous and has lost all sense. Access to basic and essential services such as water and electricity are sporadic at best. People are living under daily threat and terror.
The recent upsurge in fighting has halted progress in reaching a political agreement between the government and opposition. Meanwhile, rebel commanders accuse Russian artillery units of being involved in the fighting for Aleppo. The death toll from last week's collapsed residential building in Nairobi, Kenya, has risen to 26, with more bodies removed from the rubble, reportedly including the mother of a six-month-old infant pulled alive from wreckage Tuesday. The multi-story structure collapsed following heavy rains. It earlier was condemned, but not yet torn down. This is VOA News. The U.S. Navy SEAL killed Tuesday when Islamic State fighters punched through Kurdish lines in northern Iraq was part of a quick reaction force sent in to extract other U.S. forces trapped by the surprise offensive. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said the incident occurred in the town of Tel Shkuf, north of Mosul.
ISIL forces breached the Peshmerga forward lines. At 0750, the Americans there became involved in the ensuing firefight and called a quick reaction force. A U.S. service member was killed. The service member was part of that quick reaction force who responded. At 0932, he was struck by direct fire, and although he was medevaced within the all-important golden hour, his wound was not survivable.
The Navy identified the lone casualty as Special Warfare Operator First Class Charles Keating IV, a 31-year-old with previous experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. said dozens of IS fighters were killed in a U.S. coalition aircraft response. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter Wednesday joined officials from 11 other countries in Stuttgart, Germany, to discuss efforts to degrade and destroy the Islamic State. He said all recognize the need to do more to neutralize IS forces in their Iraq and Syrian strongholds of Mosul and Raqqa.
And these plays are, just to remind you, one, stabilizing Iraq's Anbar province. Two, generating Iraqi security forces, that is, training, equipping, positioning them, including Peshmerga, to envelop Mosul. Three, identifying and developing more local forces in Syria that can isolate and pressure Raqqa.
Defense chiefs from Australia, Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Spain, and Britain took part in Wednesday's session at U.S. Military European Command headquarters. In U.S. presidential politics, Ohio State Governor John Kasich, the last challenger to New York businessman Donald Trump in the race for the Republican Party presidential nomination, dropped out Wednesday. Texas Senator Ted Cruz dropped out Tuesday following his second-place finish in the Indiana state primary election. In South Africa's parliament Tuesday, scuffles broke out. Security guards had to be called in to remove lawmakers allied with the leftist economic freedom fighters who refused to allow President Jacob Zuma to speak. The opposition members have been vocal in support of efforts to force Mr. Zuma from office over allegations of corruption. Prominent Democratic Republic of Congo opposition leader Moises Katumbi Wednesday accepted the nomination of an opposition coalition to stand against DRC President Joseph Kabila, who has not yet announced his intentions in elections expected later this year. Katumbi, a wealthy businessman and former Katanga governor, joined the opposition last year. Mr. Kabila is under pressure not to seek a third term in violation of the Constitution. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's new unity government says it wants to secure the country first before taking on reconciliation and human rights.
The government is committed to the implementation of the agreement, and it will ensure, number one, that security is obtained in South Sudan and that everybody is in peace. It is there and then, and we can talk of accountability, peace and reconciliation.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's Minister of Information. The son of deceased President Michael Sata has defected to the main opposition ahead of the August Zambian presidential election. And the DRC government accuses a potential opposition presidential candidate of recruiting foreign mercenaries.
Following the investigation that was made by our security personnel, it seems that it was a former Marine who is working as a mercenary.
Lambert Mende is the Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Zimbabwe cautions young women and girls against being trafficked abroad. The African Union holds a conference in Dakar against desertification, and a new study says infection causes stunted growth in impoverished children. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's new transitional government of national unity, which was sworn in last Friday, says it is committed to the full implementation of the peace agreement signed last August. Information Minister Michael Makui says the government will meet next Friday to chart a way forward in line with the provisions of the agreement. The UN Security Council, in a statement Wednesday, described the formation of the unity government as an important milestone. The council stressed the need for accountability for violations and abuses of human rights during the two-year conflict. Some members, like the United States, are pressing for a speedy creation of a special court to try war crime suspects, one of the provisions of the peace agreement. But Michael Makui says the government wants to secure the country first before taking on issues like reconciliation and human rights.
The government of the Republic of South Sudan appreciates the decision of the Security Council in appreciating the establishment of the transitional government of national unity and trying to give it at least clear direction on the way forward. In actual fact, the transitional government of national unity took oath on the 29th of this month, and from then, the transitional government of national unity will meet next Friday to work out its plan of action and chart out the way forward. So at this moment, it is unfortunate that the Security Council has already gone ahead and directing the transitional government to do X, Y, Z. I say it is unfortunate because we, as a transitional government of national unity, are supposed to be given at least the opportunity to come up first with these plans before you put the cart before the horse. The government is committed to the implementation of the agreement, and it will ensure, number one, that security is obtained in South Sudan and that everybody is in peace. It is there and then, and we can talk of accountability, peace and reconciliation. There is no way you can talk of reconciliation as long as there is no peace in the country, as long as everybody in the country is not feeling secure.
The Security Council did not just do it to put pressure on the national unity government, but this was part of the agreement that was signed last year, which includes the creation of a hybrid court to investigate people who might have committed some abuses during the conflict.
Well, unless the Security Council is after accountability and not after peace and stability for South Sudan, then we can say so. But if the Security Council is for peace and peaceful coexistence in South Sudan, then this must first be obtained before you talk about accountability. You cannot talk about the hybrid court. You cannot talk about whatever at a time when you have not yet secured South Sudan. So the number one task of the transitional government of national unity is security. And if the Security Council is of opinion that we put the cart before the horse, then that is very unfortunate.
You know, Minister, it's been almost a week now since the return of your first Vice President, Riek Machar, to Juba, and the formation of the transitional government of national unity. Going into this process, there was some people who felt that it was not going to be possible for you and the rebel group to work together. How has it been since you all came together?
Well, you see, it is unfortunate that they are doubting Thomases, who would all the time like to create doubt and create suspicion. Since the coming in of Dr. Riek Machar and took oath as the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan, there had never been any problem of insecurity. The transitional government of national unity is moving forward, and there is nothing as others had been wishing.
Michael McQuay, South Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Zambia's main opposition, the United Party for National Development, UNDP, has announced the official defection of Molenga Sata of the ruling Patriotic Front, PF Party, ahead of the August general election. Mr. Sata, the son of deceased President Michael Sata and founder of the ruling PF Party, also served as minister in the office of incumbent President Edgar Lungu. Cornelius Mwitewa, deputy spokesman for the main opposition UNDP, says Sata's defection is a significant boost to the prospects of the UNDP in the run-up to the August elections.
It is not a great surprise in that Molenga Sata, the days that I've interacted with him in parliament, is a man of high intellectual esteem and integrity. Somebody who speaks, in my view, a qualitative reflection of a mindset and speaks things with a depth of understanding that one begins to admire. And so when he made the decision to join the UPND, it is not a surprise because the many well-meaning Zambians who think that working together we can redeem this collapsing economy, we can rescue this country, working together.
What does he bring to the UPND table ahead of the election?
He brings plenty in terms of the political menu for people to sample. Politically, he adds to the number. In terms of politics, it means you're adding up to perception that those who could still have been on the fence trying to see whether this UPND movement is viable or not can now make up their mind and decide that they are coming the UPND way. As the son to the former, you know, founder of the PF, I think his decision to leave the PF speaks volumes of the levels of disintegration of the Patriotic Front ahead of the 2016 elections.
I have been talking to some people in Zambia, and they said that one of the reasons why Molenga Sata left his father's party to join the UPND was because he could not produce the grade 12 certificate, a key requirement in the new constitution, and that his decision to defect to your party is actually a negative to your party, as your party's aspirations in the run-up to the election. Your take?
Well, I think that that is a very lame excuse. At all, it's very, very lame, because politics is not only about qualification. And remember, this is somebody who President Lungu made his minister in State House from being the mayor of Lusaka into minister in State House for President Lungu. After that, he made him minister for Lusaka province. So if he was deficient, why was President Lungu making him a minister, you know, in all these portfolios that he was making him? So how can he today turn out to be a negative when he was actually the personal minister to President Lungu and also Lusaka province minister?
Cornelius Mwitwa is deputy spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UNDP party. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clotty from Lusaka. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 5th. Please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The Democratic Republic of Congo's government says it has launched an investigation into the alleged use of foreign mercenaries by opposition politician Moise Katumbi. Justice Minister Alexis Tambwa Mwapa says the government has documented proof that several former American soldiers are currently working for Katumbi in Katanga province as bodyguards. Katumbi, who once served as governor of Katanga, left President Joseph Kabila's government in September and joined the opposition. He has denied recruiting mercenaries and said the allegations are intended to hurt him politically. But Information Minister Lambert Mendez says the mercenaries were being recruited through a company based in the U.S. state of Virginia.
Well, people have been arrested in Lubumbashi recently while trying to disturb the security in the street with Mr. Katumbi on 24th of April. And when they made the verification of their identity, we saw some foreigners among them, and those were an American citizen, identifying himself as an agriculture expert. But following the investigation that was made by the power security personnel, it seems that it was a former Marine who is working as a mercenary. And he was brought to Kinshasa and interrogated by justice personnel before even the embassy officials had recognized that he was a mercenary who worked in Kosovo and Iraq, and who was called in with the other friends by Mr. Katumbi. So the Minister of Justice ordered an investigation. So we are waiting the result of the investigation that will be made by the prosecutor.
Mr. Minister, as you know, Mr. Katumbi on Sunday, this past Sunday, was given, at least supported by some opposition group, that they want him to stand for president against President Kabila. So he's saying that this whole idea to investigate him is an attempt to harm him politically so that he cannot run against President Kabila.
You can say whatever you want, but if security is concerned, we must investigate. Justice must investigate. So we have to tell it to the justice. And if he is not guilty of anything, he will defend himself. It is not to the press to say that he was not engaged in criminal activities or not. It seems that we have had more than 300 people entering this country. Some of them escaped, others were arrested, and it seems that there is a security company belonging to Mr. Katumbi who was in charge of recruiting such people. But we don't know. Maybe it is not true, but it must be investigated because we are talking of security of this country and the security of our people.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Zimbabwe's Ministry of Social Welfare has cautioned young women and girls who receive employment offers in foreign countries to exercise due diligence before accepting such offers. This follows the trafficking saga of Zimbabwean women to Arab countries such as Kuwait by agents of so-called employment agencies in those countries.
Social Welfare Minister Prisca Mufumira says her ministry is currently investigating the issue of human trafficking of Zimbabwean women and girls following the return of 32 of them from Kuwait, where they were abused after being promised good jobs by employment agents. The women are part of the 200 that are in that country where they were seeking greener pastures. Mufumira urged women and girls to exercise extreme caution when seeking employment abroad.
A word of advice to young ladies looking for work in countries which they are not familiar with, to be very careful, because we've had very serious incidents of young girls who had gone to work in Kuwait and they came back reporting very serious abuse, and we are investigating to find out exactly what was happening to them.
Mufumira said her ministry, in conjunction with other organizations, would continue to work with the repatriated women and girls to ensure that they are reintegrated into their communities in a respectful way.
32 ladies had arrived over the weekend, and we expect many more to come. So the word of advice is for ladies not to venture into countries which they are not familiar with, either the culture culture, the language, and everything. Just be cautious.
Mufumira's ministry was handed over the 32 women and girls brought by a parliamentary delegation led by the Speaker of the House, Jacob Mudenda, who negotiated the repatriation from Kuwait. Opposition party MDC and parliamentarian Priscilla Misiairambwi Mushonga, who was part of the delegation that helped repatriate the women from Kuwait, castigated government for failing to take up its responsibility of making sure that citizens are safe and in cases that they face difficulties on foreign land are repatriated.
I think there are many things that government could have done. One, to make sure that these girls don't go and are not seen in terms of helping those girls when they were there. It is not our business as parliament to be doing repatriation. That to be forced to do that is an indication of the level of incompetence that is in our government. That somebody, an individual, to fundraise and fund this is an indictment on government.
Seven agents who were part of the ring that helped recruit the women and girls were held before a Harare court a few weeks ago, but are out on bail, a situation that is infuriating some women rights groups. Some Zimbabwean women and girls still remain in Kuwait and other countries where they are still victims of human trafficking.
That was Marvelous Nyahuye of VOA Zimbabwe program reporting. The African Union is holding the first ever international conference on the Great Green Wall in Dakar this week. The goal is to map out a strategy to stop desertification in the Sahel-Sahara region, which experts say is driving poverty and insecurity. Alpha Jallo reports from Dakar.
At the Climate Change Summit in Paris in December, world leaders pledged $4 billion over the next 5 years for the restoration of Africa's landscapes. That included support for the so-called Great Green Wall initiative. Now, delegates from 20 countries north and south of the Sahara are meeting with experts and grassroots organizations in Dakar to discuss the way forward. Speaking Tuesday at the opening of the conference, Senegal Minister of Environment Abdoulaye Bibi Bande explained the idea behind the Great Green Wall strategy.
La rencontre d'aujourd'hui constitue une bonne opportunité pour donner suite.
He says the Great Green Wall is about much more than simply building a simple band of greenery. He says it is a strategy to increase the value of the Sahel zone through better land use. The Great Green Wall was first proposed in 2005. It was then championed by former Senegalese President Ablaye Watt. The goal is to plant thousands of kilometers of trees and shrubbery from Senegal to Djibouti to stop the southern spread of the Sahara Desert. The certification and land degradation in the region have contributed to severe food shortages and insecurity, including the rise of terrorist groups. Amadi Job is the program manager for the Natural Resources Governance Program of the NEPAD Agency at the African Union. He says the Great Green Wall will also address drivers of illegal migration.
These range from climate change, land degradation, declining agricultural productivity, and insufficient job creation for our rural communities, to mention a few. These are ripple knock-on effects such as increased migration, rapid urbanization, creating increased demand for jobs and changing consumption patterns. For example, regarding the problem of land degradation, it is estimated that this problem affects about 65% of African population, and it is important for commensurate actions to be taken.
Experts say this conference reflects the strong political will behind the project. Now it is time for the technicians to get to work. Alpha Jallo for VOA News, Dakar.
Stunting, or failure to grow at a normal rate, is a leading cause of death among children living in impoverished areas. Until now, researchers thought the problem was due mostly to malnutrition resulting from a lack of food, but they have found an intestinal parasite that may play a major role in stunting. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Public health officials say 178 million children under age 5 suffer from stunted growth. More than 20% of them will die as a direct result of that. The experts say smaller than normal children suffer from irreversible brain damage and, if they live, continue to lead a life of poverty due to cognitive problems. Lack of proper nutrition is known to cause this stunting, but researchers suspected there was another factor. Poonam Korpi is an infectious diseases physician at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, Maryland.
Prior studies have shown that even if we took all nutritional interventions, so like vitamin supplementation, breastfeeding promotion, even if all of these were implemented, we would only reduce rates of stunting by a third in the world. So there's still a large knowledge gap in what causes growth failure in young kids.
Corby and colleagues suspected stunting might also be due to something outside of nutrition, possibly some sort of infection. They followed nearly 400 impoverished children for the first 2 years of life in a slum outside Dhaka, Bangladesh. Investigators found 3 out of every 4 of the children had experienced at least one infection with the waterborne pathogen Cryptosporidium, which is spread by contaminated drinking water and poor toilet facilities. A quarter of those youngsters suffered from a severe bout of diarrhea, but almost 3/4 of them had no symptoms at all. More than half of the children experienced stunted growth by 2 years of age. The findings were published in the journal PLOS Neglected Tropical Diseases.
Probably what's happening is that the bug is getting inside the intestines and causing irreversible damage to the lining of the gut, which probably leads to long-term malabsorption. So the body is really not able to absorb the essential nutrients that are needed for growth.
Overall, young children infected with Cryptosporidium are nearly 3 times as likely to suffer from moderate to severe stunting. Corpy says there's only one drug approved to treat the infection, but it's not available in the developing world. She concludes that adequate nutrition, along with health education, could be key to preventing infection with Cryptosporidium and the subsequent stunting of vulnerable children. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ullman in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with handball. Tunisia's Esperance are Africa Men's Handball Super Cup champions. Esperance labored hard to pip Egypt's Zamalek 33-32 in extra time to win the African top club handball accolade in Laayoun, Morocco on Wednesday. Esperance will represent Africa at the Super Global Championships in September in Qatar. In athletics, over 230 male and female athletes from 15 countries have converged in Tlemcen, some 540 kilometers west of the Algerian capital Algiers, for the Arab Junior Athletics Championships. The 4-day event, starting today, Thursday, has attracted athletes from Bahrain, Djibouti, Jordan, Iraq, Kuwait, Lebanon, Libya, Oman, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, Sudan, Tunisia, United Arab Emirates, Yemen, and hosts Algeria. Meanwhile, South Africa's University of Free State in Bloemfontein in the Free State province has been suspended from carrying out any anti-doping activities, the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, disclosed in Montreal, Canada, on Wednesday. The university can apply for reinstatement as a WADA-accredited anti-doping test facility before the end of September. Alternatively, they are at liberty to file an appeal with the Court of Arbitration for Sports, CAS. CAS is the world's highest authority in handling sports disputes, and its ruling is binding on all parties. In volleyball, Algeria and Kenya get another chance to qualify for the Women's Olympic Volleyball Contest at an international contest in San Juan, Puerto Rico. The 3-day round-robin contest starts on the 20th of May and will also feature Colombia and hosts Puerto Rico. The winner will advance to Rio de Janeiro. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Thursday, May 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very, very good Thursday.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.